So I'm happy to introduce Steve Fuller. He's going to be talking on the question, what is the entity to which a theory of scientific rationality applies such that it might be tested?
Okay, first of all, I want to thank the organizers for this, for allowing me to speak to you. I'm a little surprised, I have to say, that this topic has been revived. This is actually the topic into which I came into the field of history and philosophy of science. I have an MPhil in this subject from Cambridge and a PhD from Pittsburgh. In a sense, insofar as I'm professionally trained in anything, it's in this, I'm afraid. Okay, and some of you may know that I'm a professor of sociology in Britain, and I'm associated with social epistemology and a lot of other things, but this is actually where I began. Okay, I began in this kind of subject, and I was a graduate student, from 1979 to 85 to cover the years I was at both Cambridge and Pittsburgh, which is when the kinds of issues that we're talking about here, the possibility of testing theories of scientific change, was really at its peak. Okay, and I was part of the conference at at Virginia Tech in 1986, which became the volume Scrutinizing Science, which was alluded to earlier. And for those of you who don't, you've seen the volume perhaps, but the point was, this was a conference that basically brought in 200 people to Virginia Tech, and Blacksburg's a small town. And these were historians and philosophers, all of whom were bringing their cases from various subjects to test what had been put together by Larry, Rachel Loudon, and Arthur Donovan trying to strip down all the major historicist theories of the philosophy of science, including also the logical positivists, and into certain kinds of methodological rules, you might say. There were over 100 of them, as I recall. And then the idea would be that people would volunteer to bring their cases to bear on these. To what extent do the cases, validate or invalidate them? And some people brought in similar cases and drew different conclusions, and all of that was happening. And this was kind of a massive event. It got a lot of publicity, and there were a lot of notables in the field who sort of showed up, not because they were offering cases, but because they thought this was kind of his important moment historically in the philosophy of science. So Ronald Geary was there, and Dudley Shapir, those of you old enough to remember Dudley Shapir, right? I mean, these kinds of people who were very formative in history and philosophy of science were at this thing, okay? When I applied to go to Pittsburgh, it was originally to study with Loudon, but by then Loudon left for Virginia Tech, and then several years later I ended up replacing Loudon at Virginia Tech. Okay, this is kind of very close to me. As has been pointed out, I think, most explicitly by Luca, right, this project just fell apart very shortly after, actually, this conference. Okay, in a sense, this conference was a high watermark, where you actually did have a lot of people trying to sort of see, okay, here's a case, how methodological rules bear on this, and so forth. And one of the things that you start to see happening, especially there's an interesting exercise to be had here about looking at the reviews of this book, Scrutinizing Science, when it finally came out in 1990, okay? Because it was kind of a dull thud, basically. Even though this seemed like kind of the most explicit way to put into practice the way in which history of science and philosophy of science might actually work together in a way as, you might say, as equal partners in a sense, because certainly the philosophers, at least people like Loudon, were willing prima facie to take historians sufficiently seriously that they could, in some sense, provide disconfirmations, if not refutations, of methodological rules. At least that was on the table as a possibility. Okay, and so there were historians who actually participated in this. It wasn't just historically minded philosophers. But the thing disappeared afterwards, and I think one of the points that Luca was making that was correct, you didn't actually make the point, but I'll make it for you, is that Loudon's own interests, because you present it as a kind of contradiction in Loudon's thought, but Loudon's own interests moved away from the idea of a kind of historicist version of naturalism to this more reticular version of naturalism that one sees in Science and Values, which doesn't really rely very directly on historical evidence at all. Okay? Loudon himself moved. Okay? And became a much more generic kind of naturalist, you might say. Now, so that happened, and there are lots of reasons for this I won't go into, but it might be worth exploring. But one of the things that has been interesting, you might say, in Loudon's second life, as it were, as a legal epistemologist, which was also alluded to here, is that there is a sense of methodological, one of the things that's still on the table and we've been talking about here, which hasn't really been resolved, even though this project's kind of disappeared, is exactly what is the status of methodological rules? And you might say we've already kind of highlighted a couple of views on the table. One of them is a kind of what I would call a very straightforward philosophical normative view, which is that methodological rules govern scientific practice. Right? Or at least govern scientific practice when scientists are doing the right thing. Okay? That's one view. Now the problem is, and this is one of the things that in a way helped to undermine the credibility of this project that we're talking about, is that as the social studies of science became more prominent in the 1980s, right, and certainly in the 1990s, what you find is, in fact, that scientific practice does not conform to these methodological rules at the level of the scientific practice. So as I was pointing out this morning, right, where you see the methodology is in the talk, right, that gets used to justify publicly, after all the science has been done, to get other scientists and the public on board with it. And so you've got this kind of, from a Popperian standpoint, a kind of world three existence of the scientific literature, which has its own kind of rules, its own kind of codification, but is kind of very indirectly related to what actually scientists do. Okay, and so it was for that reason, of course, that people in the social studies of science, right, generally don't pay much attention to methodological rules, except as kind of rhetorical window dressing. Because it comes after the fact that science has been done. And how is science done? Well, you actually have to look at the particular places and cases where science is done, and you see it's done in a very messy fashion, and you can't really talk about methodological rules in this kind of normatively freighted sense, because in fact what scientists are doing isn't so much different from what other people are doing in other kinds of situations. It's just they're working with different machinery. Okay, that's kind of the sociological view in a nutshell. And so it's not that methodological rules don't have any role, but it's at a certain kind of discursive level that has a very specific function that is very important from the standpoint of the social legitimation of science, you might say, but doesn't really capture what the philosophers think, or at least some of them at least thought was capturing, namely, it somehow governs scientific practice. Now, Loudon's legal epistemology enters into this in a kind of interesting way. In terms of, why does Loudon suddenly start getting into this? And I don't want to go into what Loudon's own theories are, but why the legal epistemology angle is a kind of middle ground, you might say, in terms of how you think about methodological rules. In other words, methodological rules are things that you can hold scientists accountable to. In other words, it doesn't actually govern what they're actually doing, so we're not going to actually say that. But at the same time, it's not just rhetorical window dressing, because in a sense, they're putting it out there in the public, they're putting it out, because it's, quote, peer-reviewed, that means you have the entire scientific community backing what these guys claim to have done, right? So there's a whole lot of, institutional baggage going on here. And so what this does is, it sets up a kind of prima facie case for accountability. And that's normative, of course. It's not normative in the sense of directing the practice, but it's normative in the sense of, if you have any doubts or you find any problems, they claim to have done this. You can hold them to account. And of course, if you look at cases of fraud and all the rest of it that is very prominent now in science, right, you can kind of see the point of this. There's a sense in which, the way to carry forward this idea of methodological rules, so it isn't just this kind of very idealized notion of governing scientific practice, but neither is it the very cynical notion that it's just rhetorical window dressing, is to say, this is the sort of thing you claim to be held accountable for. So if we check your data, if we check your theory, if we check your reasoning, and we try to redo your experiments and all that kind of stuff, and we find that there are problems, you're screwed. Right? So it's a legal epistemology of science. Okay? Now, I think that, and to my mind, this may, I'm as we're rationally reconstructing Loudon's intellectual trajectory, but it seems to me that this justifies where he's gone on this matter, okay? Because I do think there is a kind of issue here about what exactly is the status of methodological rules, given the way the world has changed intellectually from the time this project was really en vogue, right, in the 1980s, right? We namely have the social studies of science, and it does cast a lot of doubt on the prima facie legitimacy of doing it in the way that the philosophers were originally doing it. Okay? But there are other issues here. With regard to methodological rules. And so in this regard, let me tell you how I kind of get into this, because I get into it in a somewhat different way. Because obviously I got into this before Loudon left the field. I got into it when he was still there. But when I got into it, so in the late 70s, early 80s, we already began to have the Tversky and Kahneman experiments that were alluded to earlier. And they're not the only ones, right? There was Nisbet and Wilson. There were a whole bunch of people. Those of you who are old enough remember Stephen Stitch. I guess he's still alive. But right, there were these philosophers of mind, right, who in a way were picking up on all the cognitive liabilities and fallibilities and so forth, right, where basically you're trying to see whether people adhere to various kinds of things like Bayes' theorem or, you know, any kind of, you know, any of the sort of standard models of rational decision making, not just in science, but in general, including economics. And you find that everyone fails. Not just the novices, not the untrained people, the trained people fail as well. And that's what made this research initially quite interesting. Right? Because there was a sense in, you know, where in a sense, having decisions that clinicians would normally make on the basis of their own kind of intuitive sense of how symptoms, you know, indicated certain kinds of diseases being present, that was bullshit. In fact, a computer could do it better. This was already being put forward in the 1980s, okay? And this was part of this kind of long trail of research that, you know, little by little started to have some purchase in the philosophy of mind and the philosophy of science eventually. And it cast into doubts whether human beings are very well designed or equipped to actually instantiate the kinds of models of rationality that had been put forward by philosophers from the logical positivist to the probability theorist to all the rest of them. And again, right, these failures, it didn't matter how well you were trained, right? And so there was this kind of issue. Now, it was in this context, in the 80s, that we start getting this kind of the great fudge word, heuristics, right? Just throw a little Greek at people and they're very impressed. So all of these psychologists and people, right, they start, because there are two issues here, right? On the one hand, there is the quite obvious and palpable failure of human beings, including trained scientists, to live up to standard philosophical models of rationality. But on the other hand, there is the fact that they still manage to get stuff done. Right? It's not like those errors have been so bad that the scientific enterprise has been this kind of crashing defeat. Right? So there's something something needs to be explained here. All right? And so people come up with this idea of heuristics. And heuristics is not a totally bullshit word, of course. But I just want to say, you know, how much work do we want this notion to do at the end of the day? Because some people, especially people of a kind of evolutionary persuasion, want to do an enormous amount of work. But let's start with, you know, as you know, many of you will know, right, that this is a term coined by William Huell. Right, in the mid-19th century, and William Huell is, you know, the great father of the history and philosophy of science, and was a theologian as well as a scientist. And the context, you know, in terms of his general kind of philosophy of science, you know, where basically Huell's this great fan of Newton, and in fact is one of the people who's really responsible for making Newton kind of the point man for what the modern scientific mind is, right? This idea of the Newtonian worldview. Of course it existed before him, but he's the one who really did the PR for it to make it like this was the world's historic thing, and this was the decisive shift. Not Galileo, not Copernicus, but Newton. Okay? Now the thing about Newton, and now remember, Huell is a theologian and a scientist and someone who believes the two things go together. For him, right, the issue of heuristics is that how can a finite being, Isaac Newton, for example, understand infinite universe, i.e. God's creation. Because somehow Newton's laws tapped into that, didn't it? Because those laws, which can be summarized in such easy way and people can understand them, nevertheless, in principle at least, explain everything possible. Most of which we will never encounter empirically. Right? That is the laws. Those are the laws of physics, right? And so heuristic then becomes this kind of interesting kind of step shift, step change, that somehow we're able to make epistemologically, where this very finite creature with all these fallibilities, original sin and all that after all, right? This is even before Tversky and Kahneman, right? Nevertheless has access to how the entire universe works. Right? There's something that needs to be explained here, but Hume took this. So in other words, heuristics, right, is invented for what is taken to be a kind of fact about the human condition, which makes this distinctive from animals. Right? Because animal knowledge is knowledge that is adaptive to circumstance. It's functional. Right? It is relative to the environments. If it goes beyond the environments, it crashes and burns because it doesn't belong there. Right? This is especially if you have a kind of intelligent design view like Hume did. Right? So this is before Darwin, but there's still this idea that all forms of life have the kinds of knowledge that are appropriate for their modes of being. And what's the human mode of being? It is to get into the mind of God. Because we're special. Right? But the problem is we're fallible. And so this is where heuristics becomes an interesting kind of... So this idea of how you manage to go from the finite to the infinite, it seems to me, was the question that was originally posed by heuristics. And so... this kind of puts the whole issue in a different kind of light. I mean, those of you who know how the history actually went on this in the 1980s and 90s, you know, once people started to take very seriously this idea that our minds weren't really well suited to process these kind of rational methodological rules, you got some different kinds of responses. And one of the people who I was very fascinated with as a PhD student, I wrote my PhD on this guy, and slightly different sort of topic, but a bit related to this, was Herbert Simon. If you remember Herbert Simon, some people look puzzled. That's disappointing. So Herbert Simon was this political scientist who won a Nobel Prize in economics, and he's the man behind the concept of bounded rationality, which was originally a concept that he developed to explain how administrators are able to make lots of decisions with imperfect information over short periods of time, where the goal isn't necessarily to get the exact right outcome, but to get a good enough outcome so you make it to the next decision. Right? And then you have a chance for improvement. Right? So it's not a matter of you either get it right or you get it wrong, but rather you get it good enough. And this is where Simon comes up with this idea, satisficing, as he called it. Right, which is kind of what you're trying to do in decision. And this is kind of heuristic, right? And this enables you to kind of move forward. This was kind of his idea. Now, once Tversky and Kahneman and a lot of these other people started talking about just how endemic this kind of imperfect, you know, rationality that we have, how it wasn't just something that, you know, decision makers with too many things to decide on and too little time and information on their hands, but it was somehow built into the cognitive condition of human beings, right? Because this is what Tversky, Kahneman, and a lot of these other guys were saying, right? Once he got on to that, right, he started thinking a little differently about this and started saying, well, you know, the problem is that, you know, it may be that we are not the right beings to instantiate the methodological rules. In other words, we can discover these rules just like we discover the laws of physics. But just because we discovered the laws of physics doesn't mean we can create the universe, right? We can know the laws of physics without being able to create the whole universe. And similarly, we may know, as it were, the laws of reason, those methodological rules we're talking about, but nevertheless, we may not be the beings who are able to instantiate it. But that doesn't necessarily make them wrong, okay? That just means we have to do some kind of ontological investigation. We have to figure out what kind of being could actually do this. Okay? Now, let me put this proposition to you as a kind of version of naturalism that people don't normally talk about. Because when we talk about naturalism, so So let's when I was doing this, right, and nobody's mentioned this yet, but one of the things that Ronald Geary used to kind of throw out there was this idea, ought implies can, from Kant, right? This comes from Kant, right? In other words, you cannot oblige people to do something unless they are capable of doing it. Ought implies can, right? You cannot oblige people to do something they cannot do. Right? Now, this was used by naturalists in the 1980s by Geary and other people as part of this general kind of downsizing, downgrading of human rationality. Right? Because if you show through experiments that human beings cannot reason according to the appropriate way, then we should not require this of them. We should start thinking that, in fact, people are getting by in some other way. And so you have then this kind of notion of heuristics arising, very closely aligned with evolutionary theory, right? And some of you here may know Gerrit Gigerenzer. Have any of you heard of him? I'm not sure, you know, what the cognitive awareness of this audience is, but okay. So this guy. So this is a guy who, in a way, takes a really different approach to this kind of issue I'm talking about from what I've been describing so far. Because one of the things that I think it is true about Simon, about Tversky and Kahneman, and about all these people who did the original empirical research showing just how deficient human reasoning is that they thought there was a problem here that somehow had to be dealt with, right? And that those confirmation biases and anchoring effects and, you know, all those other things that those guys discovered are kind of bad things in a way. And then we gotta do something about that. Somehow. Okay? But not Gigerenzer, right? Gigerenzer says this is part of our fast and frugal ways of living in the world. So all these shortcuts that we make, which do not conform to kind of rational models, but nevertheless enable us to get by, are in fact part of our evolutionary package. It's part of what, you know, so we've evolved over, you know, millennia, billions of years, whatever, and we have developed these things, and so even though they do not conform to these kinds of models of rationality that philosophers have put forward, right, they're still cool because they enable us to survive. And for Gigerenzer, rationality is about survival, nothing else, really. Survival, getting by, dealing with your fellows, dealing with nature. It's not about trying to understand the cosmos. He doesn't really talk about that one, okay? But now the thing then is, that if, you know, you got two ways, you might say, on the table of how to think about it, ought implies can. Because if you take it in the kind of standard naturalistic way, which Gigerenzer would be part of, and also I think this is what Geary was suggesting back in the 80s and 90s, right, that one way of falsifying, you know, these kind of high-minded methodological rules that say you need to look at all the evidence and you have to weigh, you have to be able to assign probabilities numerically across in some kind of Bayesian iterative process, right? Those kinds of notions, right, that human beings clearly do not do, right? That in some sense, those notions are falsified because humans are not capable of doing it. And what rather you need as your kind of model for how people reason in the world, including how scientists reason in the world, is this more down-to-earth heuristic thing, right? Which would cover stuff like what was mentioned before, where is he? Where's Mr. Kuhn here? You. right? This idea that we tolerate anomalies, right? And all this kind of, you know, this kind of Kuhn efficiency stuff. All right? That's very much in that kind of heuristic vein, where in a sense what you do is you basically kind of say, at a naturalistic level, human beings are not equipped cognitively to actually process these highfalutin methodological rules. They are, in effect, kind of fantasies. And so as a result, you actually need something a bit more grounded in the life circumstances of human beings, or in the case of, you know, with Kuhn, as it were, the life circumstances of scientists, which is where normal science and so forth plays a role, okay? And I think that was kind of the way in which, and naturalism, generally speaking, has had this kind of debunking sort of character with regard to thinking that any of the sort of classical notions of philosophical rationality would ever survive. And I mean classical, I'm covering the whole waterfront from logical positivists, Popper, Bayesians, you name it. Right? All these guys. There's just imperfection and failure. Okay? So that's one view. My own view, Okay, and this is the view I was alluding to earlier, and in a way it keeps alive some of the things that I think Huell was thinking about, right, is to say, well, look, if ought implies can, right, and we have already come up with these kinds of notions of rationality, maybe the idea is to discover what sorts of beings could actually instantiate them. In other words, you know, who is or what is an appropriate scientific agent? So the ontological question then opens up. Because I think one of the things that we have typically taken for granted in discussions about methodological rules, and this comes out whenever anyone talks about cases, is we're thinking about scientists, individual, ordinary scientists, in their own minds in some way, making decisions according to certain kinds of rules. Right? I mean, that's kind of more or less what people seem to think. People are neither thinking about science as a whole, as having its own kind of teleology or trajectory, which might exhibit rationality. Nobody's talking Hegel here, right? People are talking about a fairly localized notion, right? That if anyone, you know, if scientists are rational, if those methodological rules apply, they apply to, in some sense, actual scientists making decisions. Okay, this may be wrong, right? But my point here is this may in fact be wrong, and I think, for example. You know, I think the easy way to get into this line of thinking is to look at somebody like Popper, okay, falsificationism. Popper never said that people were falsificationists vis-a-vis their own views. They were only falsifiers of other people's views, right? Popper was perfectly aware that people were incredibly biased and prejudiced and the rest of it. In fact, this is an argument for the social character of science, where social means that you can't actually have science unless people are playing quite specific roles vis-a-vis each other in some kind of organized fashion. Which is to say, I am my own conjecturer, but I am your refuter. And we do this mutually, and we iterate outward, and that is how you get science. Okay? Now that is a norm, a methodological norm, that if you say, what is the vehicle for this methodological norm? It is not an individual mind. Right? Because it's not going to be the scientist himself falsifying his own theory. That is loopy. Everybody knows that. Rather, it's going to be you're assuming other people are going to be motivated to do it. Charles Sanders Peirce has a very similar kind of view, right, of science as a social enterprise. Okay? Now, that already starts getting you up, you know, out of the starting gate, you might say, with regard to what I'm talking about here. Namely, this idea that the vehicle through which methodological norms are conveyed is not the individual scientist, okay? Which is, you know, if you think about all those experiments that show scientists to be irrational, it's always looking at individuals making decisions about things by themselves, okay? But rather, we're talking about certain organizational forms. Now, without wishing to claim too much credit, when I wrote my first book, Social Epistemology, 27 years ago, this is the first sentence, right? That in a sense, what the normative character of knowledge is about trying to come up with the proper organization of people, right? And that organization would instantiate relevant methodological norms according to certain rules governing the relationship between those people. But you wouldn't expect any individual, as it were, to have the rule in their mind, okay? And I do think when we talk about cases from the history of science or whatever, you know, trying to see whether they actually match the methodological norms, we need to be kind of careful about this, right? Where are these norms exactly supposed to be residing, okay, if they're actually governing practice in some way? And so it's not surprising that the, you know, sociologists are so cynical, okay? But we can go further. One of the things that Herbert Simon did in the 1980s, which was something that was regarded as being very impressive when I was a graduate student at Pittsburgh. I know people nowadays aren't too impressed by these things, but as you know, the belief in artificial intelligence waxes and wanes over the decades since the Cold War. And we're now in a waxing period, and there was a waxing period when I was in graduate school too, and in between that there was a waning period. Okay, and in this waxing period, what you had was Herbert Simon, along with computer scientists and other people. He was at Carnegie Mellon University back then, and he was working with some of the best computer scientists and decision scientists around. He came up with a series of programs called Bacon, Bacon 1, 2, 3, etc., right? Named after the great Francis Bacon, founder of the scientific method, right? And so the idea would be to actually to do the following, to take a machine that has enormous computational power, admittedly this is the 1980s, so you know, it's, you know, your smartphone on a bad day is probably better, but the thing is to put in, right, all the data from the history of science and put in all of the methodological norms, you know, so arguably all those norms that Loudon and co. identified in that book Scrutinizing Science and plug it into a computer and let them analyze it. And the key thing was for Simon, and here I think Simon may have learned something from Dudley, the great Dudley Shapiro, who nobody talks about anymore. Just for you younger people. Dudley Shapiro was one of the historicist philosophers of science who was arguing very much for a kind of evolutionary model in a very specific kind of way, which is relevant to this point. Namely, he believed that, look, we come up with these methodological rules, and you know, Shapiro is trying to think about this in a really naturalistic way, and those rules are obviously going to be very abstract, they're going to, in a certain sense, be impressionistic, because they're going to be based on specific kind of cherry-picked cases. We grant all that to begin with. But one of the things is, as we get more cases, we can improve and refine the laws, so there's a learning about learning that takes place, and then we can, as we reflect at higher levels, to figure out how we can actually get better at figuring out the kinds of rules by which we can make the right inferences about the way the world works. So there's a learning about learning that is made possible once you have a critical mass of initial rules drawn from initial body of cases where you're continuing to feed in new experience, new data, etc. This was kind of the idea, and the Bacon programs were designed to do this kind of thing. And because these Bacon programs had a much, you know, bigger computational power than ordinary human mind, right, the idea was that they might actually come up with some very interesting novel findings as a result of all of this reflection and meta-reflection over time, okay? People vary in their judgments about what happened with this, and of course Simon eventually died, and people don't really like to think about these matters so much anymore. But this is, I think, a very interesting, but this sensibility hasn't really gone away. So in terms of a more contemporary philosopher who's been pursuing a similar kind of theme, I refer you to, I don't know how many of you have heard this guy, Paul Humphreys, who's a philosopher of science at the University of Virginia. And this guy wrote a book published maybe 10 years ago now called Extending Ourselves with Oxford University Press. And the thesis argued in the book was that computers, that all of these laws of rationality and things that we've been cooking up here in the history and philosophy of science, they may actually be rules about how to work a certain kind of ideal computer. Right? In other words, what all those philosophers of science have been doing all these years is cognitive science. Right? They just haven't figured out what machine it's for. And the point here is that, if what we're interested in doing science, right, is this kind of idea of being able to weigh evidence objectively and being able to assign probabilities and respond to evidence adequately and all these wonderful things that everybody agrees upon, right, then in a sense, the human being may simply be a, 1.0 platform for something that in the future will be done much more effectively by this artificial entity. Okay? And that really our theories of science are about it. Right? So again, the fact that human beings do not live up to the standards of rationality that philosophers of science have put forward, right, does not necessarily mean these things are invalid or they're just fantasies or they're based on too little evidence or any of that kind of stuff. But rather, it may mean we have not identified the right vehicle for them. We have not. So, in other words, there's an ontological issue about what being instantiates this. Okay, and in a way, this is if we were to time travel Hume to now, okay, and we say, look, Hume, this is what we're up to. He would say, well, yes, you see, this is the thing. When Newton discovered the laws of physics. Right? The way he discovered it wasn't by doing all the possible calculations that the laws of physics allowed, because that's impossible. His brain's not big enough for that. But then there is a question as who exactly could instantiate these laws of physics to enable all those calculations to be made? Ah, God. Right? This is kind of argument for God. Okay? So there's a sense in which, you know, when we talk about what's happened to this discussion about methodological rules and so forth, I think we should be a little bit more imaginative, perhaps, than we have been, because what I would hate to do is to kind of reinvent in a kind of more piss-poor way what was going on in the 1970s and 80s. And rather, we should try to raise the game a little bit, which is to say we should actually take seriously all of those methodological rules that Loudon identified and other people have been studying and so forth. We should actually take all that normative stuff very seriously, but we should be, as it were, ontologically open-minded about the kinds of entities that might be able to instantiate them. And if we do place such large normative store by these methodological rules, right, because I do think a lot of people who get into this business of scientific rationality think scientific rationality is rationality per se, right? In some, you know, self-understood, self-clarifying kind of way. If you do believe that, then there's an issue, you know, there's an interesting question about maybe we should be developing these entities in some fashion that are able to instantiate these norms if we think the norms are so important, okay? Or we might want to organize societies in a way that enable those norms to be realized, which is the kind of more Popperian attitude toward these things. Right? And so that gives you a different kind of slant of where the future of the normative lies vis-a-vis the naturalistic. Because I think at the moment, naturalism is always being used as a kind of naysayer, right? As a way of showing, you can't do it, therefore it ought not be this way. Right? Whereas that's not the only way of interpreting the issue, okay? Especially, you know, if we start to take a little bit more seriously the constitutive role of technology in the development of science and in the development of the human condition, which I think is one of the things that, of course, was completely absent in the old days, right? In the old days, when all of this, history of the philosophy of science was being done, right, science and technology were regarded as very different kinds of things, okay? But we're now in a situation where people are, and largely through the social studies of science, I would say, people are now much more open-minded about thinking about technology as constitutive of science. And of course, I'm sure all of you in the room know about this idea of techno-science, right? Once we start taking all that on board, we might think, what kind of entity, right, could instantiate these methodological norms if we think these methodological norms, given a chance to operate properly, could in fact come up with great results. And we believe that they have under limited circumstances. Okay? I was gonna talk about lots of other things, but I won't in the interest of time, I understand. But the one thing I wanna raise, because the one other topic that I wanted to get into a little bit more was this business of the history and philosophy of science and what the relationship between the two fields are. And the thing that I would say here is that this debate, this idea of one of the unfortunate consequences, I think, of the development of both the history of science and the philosophy of science on the back of this dispute over methodological rules, is that the two became more mutually alienated and as a result artificially separated from each other much more than they need to be. I actually don't buy the rule I don't buy this kind of assumption that historians and philosophers are fundamentally different kinds of people. I think that that kind of boundary got erected over the course of this debate for various reasons. But I don't think there's anything very intrinsic about it. And in fact, you know, if you look at somebody like, if you go back, you know, if you look at the classical people on this, whether we're talking about the logical positivists, you know, or Popper or any of these kinds of guys, they had very fluid notions about these things. I'll just remind you, you know, I'll close on this point. Rudolf Carnap, when he saw that Thomas Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolutions was going to be the final volume of the great positivist project, right, he was very enthusiastic, right? And he very much endorsed the kind of view that Kuhn was raising about the nature of science because you know, the way Kuhn put it, and I think you may have alluded to this in your talk, was describing science, you know, describing how science works when it works well. Right? So that fudges the descriptive and normative very nicely in a certain sense, right? And I think these, you know, all these guys were very on, you know, even though they had somewhat different views about what that meant in practice, I think they were all kind of quite open to this sort of idea, right? That there was a sense in which you would use the history to find the cases where science was doing what it was supposed to be doing, and you'd be promoting those, as it were. Now, the problem is Kuhn and Popper, for example, promoted different things, but nevertheless, that was kind of what the methodology was for those guys. It didn't involve any strict separation of history and philosophy. It was rather reading the history for the philosophical intent. And so in that respect, it wasn't so different from Hegel. Okay? And even though they came up with quite different answers, this seems to me kind of what they were going on. And so these people were quite comfortable going back and forth, right? And so, you know, one has to look to other people claiming disciplinary boundary distinctions. But those classical guys who were talking about methodological rules, they didn't respect those distinctions between history and philosophy, okay? And that includes the logical positivists, it would seem to me. And I think they were better for it, frankly, right? And that there is a sense in which too much concern about boundary maintenance with regard to historians and philosophers is really going to restrict the scope that this kind of inquiry takes in the future. So I very much advise against that. But I can talk more about this point at the questions. I won't go any further. Okay? Thank you.
Thanks, fascinating stuff. There's a lot there. But let me pick up on one idea that came to me, and maybe a suggestion of one of the reasons that whole Virginia Tech enterprise wasn't successful. And you talked about this in your talk, it's sort of clear in your abstracts as well, that one of the things that you thought was a problem was this way of identifying this, the spatiotemporal horizons of development scientific community. And we're talking about the scientists, probably not, we're talking about the scientific community as a whole, and then there are all these issues with how we have it all, and so on. So when you're comparing a philosophical thesis with the history, I guess there were different sorts of philosophical theses, and here we've been talking about methodological norms, and that's been a big focus. That was a big focus because of being at Virginia Tech. In fact, it was the focus, I take it.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas, obviously coming from this project with Tim, where we're talking about scientific realism debate, one thing that strikes me as an important distinction is the distinction between how scientists should operate, or how scientific communities should operate, where you're talking about people, basically, and when you're talking about the status of a scientific theory. And then it's a very different question about how to identify. Now, there's still issues about how to identify a theory in the history of science.
Yes.
And there were debates about that within the scientific realism debate. But one way in which you can maybe do that is that one of the main realist positions these days is to claim that only an approximately true scientific theory could give you quantitative predictive success, something like that. That's sort of a very simple way of putting it. So then you kind of know initially where to look in the history and how to carve things up, because you have to find a quantitative predictive success in the history of science,
right.
And then you have to see where it came from, what theory was being used to generate that predictive success. And so you have some way, at least, maybe, of identifying, you know, if the question is what is the entity to which a theory of scientific realism applies, such that it might be tested, it's that theory in the history of science which led to that quantitative predictive success. Maybe that could have more success.
Yes, I mean, to be honest with you, I think in the first instance, the way my concern could be addressed would be if people engaged in this game were a little bit more explicit about what units they're talking about exactly, right? And this is where the arbitrariness of how episodes are carved out, you know, becomes a problem, because you want to say, okay, we're talking about, you know, some kind of community, but how is this community being defined? Because the definition of the community to which the norm applies may in fact be a very salient feature of the norm applying, right? So in other words, a community that did not have the same structure as this community you've identified, right, would not be able to do the same thing. So what I'm thinking about is, you know, so what I'm thinking about is generalizability. What exactly are you generalizing from? And I think it's very hard to talk about how you generalize from a case to a larger body where you would like to have this norm applied because you think the norm's a good norm without really specifying this domain. What exactly is it? What is it that enabled this norm to work? What is, you know, what kind of an entity was this? How about the way it was constituted enabled the norm to work? Because that's the kind of thing you'd want to ask in terms of how generalizable it is, right? So I have no, so for example, I have no problem with the idea that there may be this, you know, incredibly powerful methodological norm of science that's only really been instantiated once in the history of science. That doesn't really bother me as long as I have a clear sense of how that instance is defined, because then I can start thinking seriously about how would I project this? How would I generalize this? How would I enable this norm to operate in other circumstances? What are the relevant features of the new case that have to be like the old case in order for the norm to work? You see, that's why the ontological question about the case is, you know, where it's, what's the boundary of the case becomes really important. It's from the standpoint of generalizability. But the fact that there's only one case in the history of science that backs the norm is not, for me, particularly problematic.
Thanks. Pardon my pronunciation. Helga?
Yes, I would like to... I have a problem with this ought implies can claim. Mm-hmm. I can't remember who said so.
Well, Kant originally, and then Geary uses it for naturalism.
It surprises me. I wonder if you could give an example. I mean, there were people in the 17th century who said that the Earth ought to be in the center of the universe. That doesn't imply that the Earth is or can be in the center of the universe, or all people ought to live in...
No, you're supposed to... the way the argument is posed starts the other way around, right? You start by saying, look, we have shown that you can't apply these norms, right? The human beings are just, you know, dispositionally ill-suited by the way they're mentally constituted. They cannot apply any of these norms. So then why do you make them norms? Right? I mean, this is kind of the argument that often gets used in ethics against Kantianism and utilitarianism, right? If you know anything about ethics, right, a lot of the naturalistic arguments against the kind of high modernist theories of ethics, Kantianism and utilitarianism, is that real human beings can't do it, right? It would require their having too much foreknowledge of consequences, or they would have to be too saintly, or have too wide an imaginative expanse to be able to understand universal conditions. Right, and this is where all these virtue theorist people get off the ground. You know, these virtue types, Alistair MacIntyre and all these reactionaries, right, they get off the ground, right, on the back of this ought implies can. That's kind of the naturalistic rear guard of ethics today, is the virtue people. Right, and so it's a similar kind of situation. I didn't go into this, but this is not just, this problem is not just isolated to epistemology and the philosophy of science. Right, it also hits ethics as well. And so the turn, just like the turn against, you know, methodological rationality in the philosophy of science over the last 25 years is very similar to the turn against the kind of Kantianism and utilitarianism, at least in their pure form, that was taken for granted pretty much when I was a student. Now we've got this whole new wave of naturalists who basically think that, you know, Kant and Bentham were just talking about fantasy.
Thank you. This is a very simple question. So you suggested we consider what kind of beings instantiate our notion of rationality, and just simply, so where do we get the notion of rationality to begin with? What's the sort of default position, and how do we justify that notion of rationality? I mean, you have naturalists.
I'm a reflexive naturalist. So I realize the limits of naturalism by knowing the history of naturalism.
And then you have you also use the notion of pre-analytic notion of rationality.
Yeah, yeah.
So where do we take? Or is it the Lorentz methodological rules? So what kind of principle of rationality do we try to?
Look, what I believe has happened in all this, okay, And this is why at the end I was defending kind of the way the logical positivist and Popper and even Kuhn, you know, I think they're all kind of agreed on this point. Namely, there is a sense in which there is a kind of intuition from the individual to the universal that's taking place. You know, epagoge, or, you know, this kind of Aristotelian thing, right? Where, you know, abduction maybe. Right, we're in some sense, right, that there are these cases that strike you that, right, you know, this worked brilliantly. They actually made a very sharp move, right? They did something very significant intellectually. What is it they did, you know, that we could perhaps generalize from? And so you don't assume that these cases are normal, though Kuhn does, but you don't need to, right? You could say that they're exceptional, but once you've identified them, you've identified something quite special, okay? And I think the whole focus on science as opposed to just general knowledge, right, because this is where I think the philosophy of science has a kind of interesting way of distinguishing itself from epistemology, is that in a sense the burden is on the philosopher of science to say, okay, we're looking for epistemic practices or rules that are a cut above the rest, right? They're the best. Okay, it seems to me you start you wouldn't have philosophy of science separate from epistemology if you didn't believe that to begin with. And I think the way philosophers have proceeded have been to cherry pick cases. But you know, and this is where you have to think about, okay, you may discover something intuitively, and this goes to your point about the importance of discovery, right? But then the question becomes, okay, how do we generalize this? Because generalization is ultimately going to be the way in which you justify, right? The ability to take a case where you say a certain kind of methodological rule has been in place, right? And then be able to show that using this rule in this situation, in this context, does wonders too. That's the way to go, it seems to me, to justify things. And I take it that's kind of the spirit in which all this philosophy of science was being conducted, right? So there was never really, I think, a great deal of sleep lost over whether this represents all of the history of science, these rules, or anything like that. Maybe Kuhn lost sleep over this, right? And this is where Kuhn, I think, really kind of perverted the game a bit, because Kuhn clearly was going for normal, right? He was looking for normal practice rather than best practice. And I think everybody else was looking for best practice. I mean, you know, this is the kind of thing, you don't want to know what the model for cases are here in business schools. Business schools, case histories in business schools, right? Best practice. And then you analyze, what is it about this practice that makes it so good? Why did it work in this context? What is it that we can learn from this that we could generalize to some other context? Okay? I'm not saying these business school people are Einsteins, but they figured this much out about what the point of a case is. Okay? And I do think that that's kind of where the philosophers of science, their intuitions, I think, are in that direction. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, so you're a pragmatist, right?
I think at this methodological level, but I think you really couldn't get this whole project off the ground if that wasn't your view. I mean, it seems to me, because insofar as you think that the positivist Popper, all these guys were not just completely crazy, you know, or making, you know, elementary epistemological errors or something, right? It seems to me this is kind of what's implicit, right? That you can find exemplary cases intuitively, and then you try to figure out what is exemplary about them, which means a certain amount of abstraction, and then you try to generalize to other cases. Now, that's the part where they didn't do very well, was generalizing to other cases. They never really had a kind of strategy, you know, of policy in a sense, right? Of how do you, you know, once we've identified what's worked in a certain case, how do we then get it out there so it can work in other cases? That's the part where they failed tremendously, okay? But otherwise, it seems to me that is kind of where they were going. And I would see that, to me, that's not a stupid idea.
I'll just make a comment if I may. So a lot of times when you're thinking about, I often with my students teaching philosophy of science talk about descriptive challenges versus prescriptive challenges. And when you think about sort of let's just start with the really straightforward inductivist program, which I think the Bacon started out the Bacon program was trying to kind of get that going, and
yeah.
tried to get Kepler's law. They tried to put the data in, see if you could get Kepler's laws, and it was a complete bomb.
Right.
But then they probably packed in a few assumptions. And I don't know what happened, but then I'd be interested to find out.
Yeah, they went through seven iterations.
Seven. And then they just let it go.
Well, you know, that's the way it goes, I'm afraid. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So Newton gives his rules of reasoning, and Duhem has this really interesting critique, and I sometimes think of this as the quiet revolution that occurred in 1905 and 1910. And that is where Duhem shows there's no way you could have ever gotten what Newton got if you used the method that he said he used.
Yeah.
And you know, he could show this logically, you could actually prove it, that you couldn't ever get to Newton's laws if you just use the inductance, straightforward inductance. And the quick version is, you're never going to get a theory about neutrinos if you're generalizing from koala bears, something like that, right? You're never going to get unobservables. And it's really funny when you look at all the people that were advocating this empirical generalization as the way science works, and then all along you've got unobservables creeping. And even Bacon, when he's talking about it, he brings in the particle's motion as an account of heat, presciently anyway. So there's that component, and then if you think of, take an example with Popper, a critique of Popper is, you not only is it the case that people don't throw their theory out and it's falsified, and then they give all these instances, right? There's also this other claim, and a lot of people, in addition to Kuhn, make this point. And there's another claim, you certainly shouldn't do that, right? Because then you have no framework to come at the world with. And so it's good that they didn't throw out Newton's theory when it ran into falsification, and they threw out its career and, all the way until it was overthrown. And so then there's the descriptive and normative that do kind of play into one another and are sometimes, in some of those examples, packed in. There's a normative component that's also included. And so I wonder if you might reflect on that a little bit with regard to the ideal computer doing the work. There's still a little bit of an odd implies kin, but then there's also something about these. Sometimes there's a challenge to the ought as well that is packed into these. And oftentimes, I think with some of these historical challenges against positions, there's a challenge to the ought part.
Oh yeah, no. I think in fact, from a naturalistic standpoint, I think the normal way to think about this is it's challenging the ought, right? That these cases, in a sense, are meant to falsify the ought in some sense, right? Or at least, or maybe, and I think this is where the social studies of science had a lot of influence, to discourage you from thinking in methodological terms at all, right? That in a sense, people in social studies of science would tell you, you shouldn't even be thinking about these questions because they don't really have any purchase on anything that corresponds to what science does, okay? And clearly, though, the people who do the computer programs don't believe that, right? The computer program guys, artificial intelligence guys, are very much on board with the classical philosophers on, philosophers of science on this. So my own view is, and this is my view from the very beginning, because I'm someone who's normally seen as very sympathetic to the social studies of science, I am. But I've always seen it as really no more than an empirical check, a kind of reality check thing. Right, that there's a lot more going on here. And also I think there's this issue I think that social studies of science brings up in terms of what we mean by governance. If we're thinking about rules as governing practice in some way, in what sense does that governance happen? In what sense might one want to, because it's one thing to say, okay, I'm looking at a particular case in history and I can kind of see that there's something that corresponds to this method I'm talking about here. And maybe I find the guy says a few things in his books that correspond to this and all of that. But that doesn't really tell you much about governance, about how the actual activity of science is being conducted. And I think that's kind of the deeper question, the deeper challenge that the social studies of science people put for philosophers. But this is why I mentioned Loudon's legal epistemology earlier, because it may be at the end of the day, that with regard to human beings, not necessarily with regard to computers, who may actually be able to process all these rules, but with regard to human beings, the role of methodological rules may be as this kind of accountability structure, something that someone can hold you to account. So if your practice is shown not to have conformed to it because we redo your experiment, then we prosecute you because you have claimed this as your own. Right, so insofar as scientists want to claim the methodological rules as the norms, that they stand by, in a sense, it's less important that they're actually governed by them than the fact that they're willing to be prosecuted by them.
That's where I think the legal epistemology angle is pretty good for human beings. For the computers, we might want to talk about governance, the rules governing the decisions that are being made in some kind of clearer fashion. And so that's why I say that the philosophers, I think historically, were really thinking about machines rather than thinking about human beings.
Any other questions? Thanks, Peter. Go ahead.
So we seem to be in the age of methodological formalism. I recently, in the Routledge Encyclopedia for Philosophy of Science, I think it's just stated, you know, just this is orthodox now. So we shouldn't be thinking about what's the method of science anymore. You know, that's just passé. We shouldn't be thinking.
What are we doing here?
what I'm thinking was, you know, why wasn't this considered at the time in the Virginia Tech?
I mean, well, methodological pluralism.
I mean, Feyerabend had already put this forward in the 70s. Okay, maybe it was dismissed, I don't know, at that time. But like now, if this happened, people would be thinking, don't try and come up with rules which you've always be adhered to, but think about the different methodologies of science which have been successful, and any of which could be applicable in some new case.
Yeah, but see, that kind of pluralism isn't a problem. In this, it just restates the problem, right? Namely, we still have to figure out, how do we generalize from specific cases to other cases? I mean, that problem is still there. I don't see how pluralism adds any content to this.
Well, I mean, you certainly wouldn't be refuting a methodology if you found counterexamples. I mean, you would just be like, oh, that's just one methodology which applies in certain circumstances.
I think that the spirit of the people who were involved in Virginia Tech, as well as I would say the Herbert Simon and all these computer guys, was that, if you look at all these methodological rules, none of them applies to every case, but the interesting question is, what is the domain to which they apply? And so what this would be the ideal, as it were, the ideal outcome of this kind of exercise that went on in Virginia Tech. That's not what happened. I mean, what you saw was a kind of a admission of defeat in a way, because what did you get? You got the initial statement that listed whatever hundred and something rules, and then the various cases which kind of made their own individual claims, and that was pretty much left that way. But the original intention was to actually figure out, you know, okay, this kind of rule applies in this kind of range of cases, right? So in other words, you'd be able to articulate the methodological rules more thoroughly with regard to the historical evidence. Say, under these circumstances, maybe under specific disciplines or under specific kind of research methods, right? This works. This kind of rule works well in laboratory settings. This works well in the field setting, right? But this was kind of more what they were trying to get at, right? It was that kind of articulation, right, that the cases might be able to provide some evidence for, but they really couldn't come up to any sort of agreement on that, so they just sort of left it as an open issue. But that would be kind of what you would want to do. You'd want a more articulated version of the boundary conditions under which the rules would work. You see what I'm saying? I mean, I think that's not an unreasonable thing to be looking for. And that's kind of how Simon's programs work, too. They look for boundary conditions under which various rules actually have the kind of efficacy that's desired.
All right, second speaker.
Thank you.